It is good to see you tonight. Good to be with you. And with Shane and Jason coming on board to lead this, I'm excited. It's just such a great thing to see young leaders coming up. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, we probably should have like a little voting thing to see which one you think most reminds you of Marvin, which one most reminds you of Terry, you know, which one can raise the most money. We got to figure that out. The other thing that I loved tonight was this. Where else but a gathering of a cappella churches could you sing one phrase of Country Roads, Take Me Home, and have perfect four-part harmony? That was amazing. I know. It was amazing. I just thought there is no way that just happened. I was waiting for a little bit more on the Journey song, but we didn't get it, did we? I want you to go ahead and open your Bibles to Psalm 130. And we're going to spend some time this evening talking about redeeming our past. Psalm 130. Let's start reading beginning in verse 1. Out of the depths I cry to you, O Lord. O Lord, hear my voice and let your ears be attentive to my cry for mercy. If you, O Lord, kept a record of sins, O Lord, who could stand? But with you, there is forgiveness, and therefore you are feared. I wait for you, O Lord. My soul waits, and in his word I put my hope. My soul waits for the Lord as a watchman waits for the morning, more than a watchman waits for the morning. O Israel, put your hope in the Lord, for with the Lord is unfailing love, and with him is full redemption. He himself will redeem Israel from all their sins. We're coming up on Easter, not too far away, and we're going to be spending a lot of time in at least the end of one of the four Gospels. I'm guessing that as the ministers and elders and so on and Bible class teachers are preparing to preach and teach on that weekend, we're going to come across a journey. We call it the walk to Emmaus. And it's these disciples who, in between the death of Christ and the resurrection, are on their way walking to Emmaus, and Jesus catches up with them. They don't recognize him. They don't imagine it would be him. They've just watched his tragic death. They know he's been buried. But I want you to listen to the words of the conversation they have with Jesus as he approaches them. It says one of them in Luke chapter 24 and verse 18, one of them named Cleopas asked him, are you the only visitor to Jerusalem and you don't know the things that have happened here in these days? What things? Jesus asked. Well, about Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and the rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was going to be the one to redeem Israel. See, they have Psalm 130 on their mind. That in the Lord there is full redemption. That the Lord himself will redeem Israel. But you see, when people think of redemption, we think of it on basically three levels. The first level when we're thinking about redemption is that it takes a person, a redeemer. In fact, if you remember when Jesus was taken to the temple as a child, remember Simeon came and blessed him. And after that, the prophetess Anna. Do you remember that? And you remember that she stepped forward and she spoke to all those in Israel who were awaiting the redemption of Jerusalem. You see, they imagined that a redeemer would come. When Jesus did a miracle, they said, the Lord has come to redeem his people. The redemption is going to come in a person. And Jesus, they thought, was the Redeemer. It's Job that thanks God that his Redeemer lives. There is this history that there is a Redeemer. Not just redemption, but there's a Redeemer. And notice the disciples lament because they say, we thought we'd met the Redeemer. From there, you'll notice that this passage goes deeper in Psalm 130, though. It says, he redeemed Israel from their sins. When Jesus was born, they said, call him Jesus because he'll save his people from their sins. And this brings up the next two levels of redemption. When people think of redemption, and this is critical for us, they're thinking to themselves, number one, I will recognize redemption when it comes. I'm going to recognize it. That when redemption arrives, my eyes will be open. My spirit will be tuned. There will be something about the Redeemer that will click with me. And I'll know that redemption has arrived. And the third issue is, similar to it, the process of redemption won't be foreign to me. The process won't be foreign. Not only will I recognize redemption when it comes, but the process of redemption will not be foreign to me. We love stories of redemption. We're excited by stories of redemption. I want to tell you a story of redemption tonight. This picture that we're going to put up on the screen, this is a picture of a man. His name is Madesh. And when they bring that up, you got it coming up. This guy and his family lived for 15 years as slaves. Not back in the time when God told the people of Israel or told Moses, I'm going to rescue the people of Israel. Not in the times of the enslavement, of the period of enslavement in the United States. This is a modern day, one of the 27 million slaves around the world. Madesh and his family were enslaved. It was ethnic enslavement. For 15 years, they worked in a kiln. This week, on Monday, I received this picture in the mail. It was framed in a large frame. The reason that I received this picture is because they were bought out of slavery. This family, they're no longer slaves. They were bought out of slavery. I think it's awesome. But you need to know how Madesh and his family were redeemed. You need to know what happened. You need to know the story because you see, I'm guessing that someone starts praying for freedom as soon as they're enslaved. I doubt there's ever been a slave that thought to themselves, I'll see how this works out and then I'll decide whether I want freedom or not. I doubt there's ever been a slave that thought to themselves, well, you know, it could work. People in slavery want to be redeemed. And if this guy's been in slavery for 15 years and his family has been enslaved during that time, that means that his children were born into slavery. But as of today, they are free. They were redeemed. The international justice movement, with monies provided, bought them out of slavery. But there's a story. July 4th weekend of 2008, I was in Nashville. My wife and I went up there. I was supposed to speak for Celebration, which is the Lipscomb University lectureship. I went up there and I was supposed to do an evening keynote like this. It was on a Thursday evening. My wife and I went. Lynn Anderson was speaking and we'd heard him the night before. We were really excited to go hear him again at the late night offerings. So after I finished the keynote, we sat down right down front. I said to my wife, here's the plan. You go by Starbucks, picks up some fuel, and then we'll meet at Lynn Anderson's. And she said, all right. So there's screens up in front like this. We're watching the screens and they're scrolling the evening activities. Well, as they're scrolling the evening activities and I'm sitting there watching, my name scrolls up the screen. And it says, Don McLaughlin unplugged with the youth. I thought, well, since I didn't know I was speaking, you have no idea how unplugged this is. I mean, it's so unplugged, it's non-existent. So I told my wife, double shot, two of them, I'll meet you with the youth. I text my son, who's a senior there. I said, where is this building? Where is this room? So I'm on my way over there, and I'm thinking to myself, what in the world is God going to do? So I get there, I find them, I walk in. As the youth minister is up there telling them how great the evening is going to be, I'm counting these students. How many students will I disappoint this evening? There were exactly 40. I thought, well, I've disappointed more. This will be a light one. So I go in, and we're ready to go. But I'd been reading an article, and the article was entitled, The Greatest Cause Generation. Taking kind of a cue from Tom Brokaw's book, The Greatest Generation, the author was talking about the youth and experiential living, and that this generation, more than any generation in the history of the United States, is a volunteer, cause-oriented generation. Get them involved. So I thought, way to go, that's the key. I walked in, I stood up, and I said to them, glad you're here tonight. Get into groups of four or five. And that's what speakers do when they have no clue as to what to do next, you know. Get into groups of four or five, and what I want you to do is decide what you believe are the three biggest problems in the world, and if you could wave a magic wand tonight, what problems would you solve? Get into your groups. Well, they're kind of staring around, so they get into little groups, you know, one, two, three, four, one, two, three, no, we need another one, you know, four, five, okay, we got them. And they start doing it. Well, they come up with the normal answers, and they're good answers. Problems that have to do with world hunger, war, HIV, AIDS, abortion, poverty, children's health issues. Great answers. After they finished, still didn't know what I was going to do. So I said, get back into your groups. See, I put them back in the groups and I said, now what I want you to do is pick one. Pick one of those problems and decide what you're going to do tonight to start solving it. So they got back into their groups. I gave them a few minutes. Then I called them back to order. The group over here on my right, they said, we want to do something about abortion. I said, that's terrific. What do you want to do? They said, we want to hold a protest. And I said, well, tonight, you know, because we're on Lipson's camp. I mean, we could, you know, it's 9 o'clock. And we could. I didn't want to dampen their spirits, but they said, well, maybe that won't work. So we moved on to the next group. And what about the next group? And they said, we want to do something about world hunger, specifically children. I said, that sounds like a great idea. What do you want to do? A young man in there that I could tell was very intense and authentic said, well, what I'd really like to do is I would like to go to a third world country. I'd like to see it for myself, come home, make a plan that I know will meet a need. Now, I thought, you know what? He's thinking ahead. That's not bad. That might be tough to do tonight, but he's thinking ahead. So I asked, is there anyone else here that has already been to a poverty-stricken situation like that? Over to my left, four girls raise their hands. So I invite the girls over and I ask them, tell us about it. They said, we've been down to Ensenada, Mexico, to the City of Children, which I anticipate several of you have been there as well. They said, we've been down there. We've seen the situation. I interviewed them on the spot. I said, hey, tell me a little bit about it. They told me about it. And I said, what was it like when you hand the children back to the caretaker and you know you're driving north across the border, you're going back to a warm bed, a full refrigerator, and they're going back to an uncertain future? You could tell tears in their eyes. They'd really been touched. So I said to the youth, how many of you still agree that we should do something about poverty and hunger, especially for children? 39 out of 40 hands right in the air. I said, all right. How many of you would feel comfortable helping this group, since we have representatives, would you help them? 39 out of 40 hands. I said, all right, what I want you to do is reach into your pockets, reach into your purses, take out your money, and put it on that table, and we'll give it to them. You mean like right now, like my money? And I said, well, yeah, how tough can this be? We don't need to form a committee, plant a church, call an elders meeting, consult the deacons. They're poor. They need food. You have money. You have food. So you give your money to them, and then they have food. This is not rocket science, people. And they did it. These kids started reaching in their pockets. That's right. And they started putting their money up there and in their purses. And pretty soon we had a little pile of money there. And so I said to the girls, I said, why don't you count the money? So they counted the money. There was about $40. They said, I said, I could tell by the look on their face. I said, I know that doesn't sound like a lot of money. But those of you that are involved in this, you know that the international average for food, clothing, and shelter for a child in the world is $37.50 for a month. I said, so it may not sound a lot like to you, but to the kid that didn't have to go through the garbage in order to eat for the next month, that's a lot of money to him. Amen? And so they were like, oh my goodness. So the kids start thinking, hey, can I run back to the dorm room? My family's staying in the dorm room on campus. Can I get some money? If you want to. It's your idea. Well, hey, I've got some more. Can I give it? If you want to. It's your idea. Now, remember, there were 40 kids, but only 39 had voted. Well, see, there was a girl in the back. She was with her boyfriend. Up to this point, I didn't even know she had hands. I'm sure they were there, just not where I could see them. She raises her hand. She said, Mr. McLaughlin. I said, yes, you have hands. I didn't say that, but I'm surprised. I said, yes. She said, can we ask the adults here at Summer Celebration to help us with this? I said, you can if you want. She said, no, I mean, would you ask him? I said, no. She said, well, she's persistent. Well, are you speaking to them again? I said, I am in the morning at the general session. She said, well, won't you ask him? I said, no, but I'll make you a deal. If you show up at the general session in the morning, I'll call you up and you can ask him. Okay. So the next morning, I get there, session just like this in an arena similar to this. I get up and there sit those four girls. So I told the audience what happened the night before. I called the four girls up. They made their plea to the adults. At the end, I said, we're going to position these girls, and one of their fathers was a minister. I said, we're going to position these kids around the auditorium. You can go give them money, and all the money you give them will go straight to these orphans in Ensenada, Mexico. How about that? 1 hour later, when Jerry Taylor had finished his keynote, Walt Lever, who is one of the administrators at Lipscomb, turns around to me and says, do you have a total? I said, I don't, but I think they do. He calls the girls up on stage. They had been given $4,000. Okay? Now, this is within less than 24 hours. So these kids from El Cajon, California are now overjoyed that God is at work in their lives. They go home. How exciting is this? They go back to their little church back in El Cajon, California. They tell the story and they're ready to rock and roll to help these orphans. I go home back to Atlanta. I'm stunned by the situation. I get up the following Sunday morning, July 4th weekend, and I tell the story to our church. All week long, people are calling in. We got to do something like this. 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 I said, well, I need some ideas. They said, well, why don't you just do what you did up there? Well, that would be a good point. So the following Sunday morning, with the elders backing the idea, we got up and said, after our regular contribution, we finished the sermon. I said, folks, it sounds like we ought to do something. We support orphans homes, orphans groups in Kazakhstan, Ukraine, Nigeria, and Mexico. And I said, what we're going to do this morning is there's a communion table. Just come down, pile your money on it. We'll split it four ways. Whatever you give, we'll split it four ways and send it to them. I mean, like now. And down they came. And it piled over. Our security team is looking at me like, you know. Our accountant just shaking her head. Yeah. But the people kept coming. So we counted it up. $46,000. All right. So we split it four ways. And we send it out. And we get a letter back from Nigeria. Our generator went out. That was the amount of money we needed. We get a letter up from, or an email up from Mexico. You sent the exact amount of money that we needed to finish the floors in the houses we've been building. We get a letter in from Kazakhstan. Our furnace has been out since December, and this is July, and now we've replaced the furnace. We're thinking, man, God is wildly at work. This is something that Terry Rush would be in the middle of. So then, that week, I get a call from a guy who had been at church that Sunday. He said, hey, could you drop by my office? I said, okay. So I went over there, dropped by his office. He said, man, what God is doing is beautiful. What he did with those kids touched my heart. He said, I want to keep this thing going. I said, all right, what do you got in mind? He said, I want to give $1 million. I want to give $1 million and I want you to give it to the congregation. And tell them to go help people with it. And let's see what God does. Sounds easy. So I came back to the elders and I said, hey, here's what this guy wants to do. As a church, those of you that have visited our church, we're a very close family. And we have probably 150 to 200 former cocaine addicts that are part of our church. There's no way that we're going to compromise their sobriety or our relationship with the recovery community by giving people, just handing out money. We have people there that have been clean from cocaine sometimes for 12 or 14 hours the first Sunday we're there. So it's not going to work for us to give out money. The recovery community tell us we're irresponsible and we don't care about what we're doing with them. So we had to figure out a way that we're all going to move forward together, or we'll call another local church and let them fulfill it. One of the two ways. We had important values that we were weighing there. We took 2 weeks. We figured out a way to include all of our members, all the way from the first grade all the way up to the people that are nearly 100. We figured out a way to include the people that had their addiction in their background, and figured all that out. Went back to the guy, said, let's do it. We're excited. All right? So we start plugging forward. Now remember, this is the summer of 2008. We start putting a plan together, and then September of 2008 hits. Now some of you, when I said that, just popped a Zantac, because that's when your 401k tanked. If you remember, that's when the economy showed its signs of an eruption. In October, the brother calls me on the phone and he says, hey, listen, I'm sorry, we're not going to be able to do this. I've got to pull this off the table. I said, hey, you know what? No problem. The only people that know about it, shepherds, you, myself, the donor is completely confidential, totally anonymous throughout the whole thing. I said, that's wonderful. It's not an issue. I come back, I tell the elders. The elders wisely said, why don't you go ahead and put a plan together anyway? Because if the Lord brings it back around, we'll be ready. Okay, sounds good. So we put a plan together. We're done by December. We enjoy the Christmas season, move into the new year. And then we move into a year, 2009, that is absolutely the most tragic and difficult year in the history of our church. I can't recount for you everything that happened, but we had tragedies and losses that in the over 50-year history of our church, we've never had tragedies and deaths and losses like this all in one year. It was absolutely traumatic. But God is at work. And God is at work redeeming us as a people. June 18th of 2009, I get a phone call. Guy says, what's up? I said, well, I just went and bought a wood chipper. He said, a wood chipper? He said, where'd you find a wood chipper? I said, I found it outside of Monticello, Georgia. Wow, I said, I didn't know there was anything outside of Monticello, Georgia. I said, I didn't either. When I looked at MapQuest, the last three turns were Cut-through street, apt to miss road, and we hunt. I'm not kidding. I'm on my way back. I found myself out of the swamp logger's land. I get on the road. He says, hey, listen. He said, I want to talk to you about the gift. I said, what about it? He said, my mom taught me to live by faith, not by fear. Last fall, I lived by fear, and I've regretted it. I went into my board of my company today, and I had a conversation with them, and I told them I'm repenting. I said, you used repent in an American corporate board meeting? He said, I absolutely used repent in an American corporate board meeting. And I told them that I was not going to live by fear, that I was going to live by faith. I want you to come by and pick up the check. I said, can I call you back? He said, yeah, I call one of our elders. I said, hey, here's what's going on. He said, okay, I call my accountant. She says, our church accountant. He said, it's all good. So I drive over, I pick up the check. I come back to the office, I hand the sealed envelope to our accountant. Our accountant comes in and says, did you look at the check? And I've just had a pattern in my life that I don't ever do that kind of stuff. I don't involve myself in that kind of stuff. She opens it up, she shows it to me. It's for $1.5 million. So last fall, we go into a journey centered around the Good Samaritan, except we're not the Good Samaritan, we're the innkeeper. We're the one that somebody gave us money and said, would you go help someone? We're the innkeeper. So we give out the money. We give it out in vouchers so that people can say, well, hey, I want to help this person, and the congregation goes wild helping people in apartment complexes, helping people, their neighbors, helping people at school, going down to the jail, sending it to missionaries. We had one guy that told us about a neighbor in an apartment complex. The neighbor was behind on his rent. So we went to the people that owned the apartment complex. This member of our church went in there and said, I'd like to take care of my neighbor's rent. The apartment complex owner was overwhelmed by that. A couple of weeks later, he called us on the phone and he said, I have some other people that are behind on their rent. Can you help us? One of our elders wisely said, let me tell you what this was about. Our elder told the whole story. That apartment complex owner said, thank you very much. I'll call you back. He called back in a week and said, let me tell you what we did. We told everybody in the apartment complex that had lost their jobs, you get December free. You get the next 3 months half price of whatever back issue you got. It's all settled and forgiven. That is God at work. Well, in the middle of all this whole thing, I was asked, I'd already been asked and scheduled to go back and speak at Lipscomb. This had been on the docket for 10 months. So I'm on my way to go back up and speak at Lipscomb Chapel, and Walt Lever calls me on the phone. His daughter-in-law is a member of our church, is a member of our church. Son-in-law is one of our youth ministers. He said, will you come and tell the story in chapel? It started up at Lipscomb. We want you to tell the story. I said, okay. So I'm up there and I'm telling the story just like I'm telling you. And after chapel, the last person to come and talk to me is a young lady. She walks down to the front. She says, do you remember me? I said, I'm sorry, I don't. She said, my name is Kimberlyn Frensley. She said, I'm the girl in the back of the room. She said, I was sitting up there in chapel today listening, and I just started weeping. She said, you have no idea where I was that night. I didn't even want to be at Lipscomb. I didn't want to be at Celebration. I didn't want to go to some dumb youth thing. I was the oldest person there. She said, I sat in the back with my arms folded with a boyfriend I shouldn't be with, and I had no idea that God could use me. She said, I'm sitting there this morning in chapel, listening to a time in my life, a year and 5 months earlier, where I was so confused and in so much darkness. In fact, I want you to see Kimberlyn's picture. Let's bring up Kimberlyn's picture. This is Kimberlyn Frensley. I said, Kimberlyn, if it hadn't been for you, it would just have been a moment, but God used you to turn it into a movement. You raising your hand in the back of the room was God using you at a time when you didn't think you could be used, when you looked at your present and it was dismal. You looked at your past and it was worse. And you didn't even want to think about the future because there was no hope. And now what God has done is God has gone to work and he's created a movement of redemption. And he used you, but he wanted you to be here this morning so that you could hear that he is at work in your darkness, in the valley of the shadow of death. When you think you've blown it and there's no way out, God is at work in your life. I walked out of there and I just thought to myself, man, I got to keep in touch with her. I get on the road. I'm driving on my way back to Atlanta. I've got her cell phone. I hit her cell phone. I said, Kimberlyn, you've got to come to church. You've got to come to North Atlanta. People need to meet the girl in the back of the room. The following weekend, we flew her down to Atlanta. We picked her up at the airport. She said, I still can't believe God is doing this in my life. We brought her in Sunday morning. I shared the story like I'm sharing with you. And I said, I want the church to meet the girl in the back of the room. And she came forward. And when she came forward, the church stood and cheered. Cheered a girl. Cheered a teenager. Cheered a girl that didn't want to be at a youth rally. Like one of your kids or like you. And it cheered a person who was in darkness, sitting in a spiritual gathering, feeling nothing, can't sing the songs. Scripture seems dead. Prayers seem hollow. They were watching the girl in the back of the room with intensity because they are the girl in the back of the room. And so are you. Maybe not tonight. Maybe you are. Or maybe it's when your child walked away from the Lord and you sat there and you tried to sing, Blessed Be Your Name. But every time you start that song, your throat chokes up and your stomach's in a knot. Shalom is gone. And it's so hard to sing. Some of you sat there tonight and you watched people sing It Is Well With My Soul, and you might have even thought, good for you, but not for me. But you see, God is not bound by our limitations. God is still at work. When Kimberlyn got up there and she sat down with me up on stage to share with the church, she looked out and caught the eyes of her mom and dad, who had awakened at 3 a.m. on a Sunday morning and drove from Nashville to surprise her by being there. Can you imagine the joy she felt and they felt in the redemption that God was bringing about in her life? But God wasn't done, and he's not done, because with him is full redemption. And you see, what happened is one of our families had been on the internet reading about slavery through Zach Hunter's website, a modern day abolitionist. And they clicked on a link to the International Justice Movement. And they gave their money that they had been given. And they bought Madesh and his family out of slavery. And that is full redemption. This is God at work. You see, God doesn't even need you to be doing well for him to be working redemption in you, for you, and through you. God can take a chief of sinners. God can take the broken. God can take a David that blows up half the Ten Commandments in one fall. God is the God of redemption. God is the God of U-turns and turnarounds. God is the God who says, listen, I am at work right now. You say, well, I don't even believe in you. He says, I don't need you to believe in me in order for me to be involved in redemption of you. God says, I am redemption. I am the Redeemer. He says, so let me explain it to you like this. He said, you're right about the three phases of redemption. One, a Redeemer is a someone. And redemption comes through someone. But he said, I can't promise you anything on the next two. I can't promise you that you'll recognize it. And I can't promise you that the process will not be foreign to you. I can't make those promises. Madesh is praying for his family. Lord, rescue us from slavery. I doubt he thought he would be rescued through the hand raising of a girl in darkness with 40 kids for a minister that didn't even know he was supposed to preach that night. I don't think Madesh said, hey, Lord, here's what I'm thinking. Don McLaughlin, unplugged, brainless. Send him down there with a girl that doesn't want to be there so that she'll raise her hand having not participated whatsoever and bring in a guy who can give that money. And how about if we do it like that? No, Madesh is just like the people of Israel. Lord, rescue us. And God says to Moses, I've heard their cry. Just like David, Lord, I cry out to you in the night. God says, I heard your cry. Just like the two on the road to Emmaus, we thought he would be the Redeemer. I am the Redeemer. God says to you, you know your Redeemer lives. Because I am redeeming you. You're not redeeming yourself. I'm redeeming you. I am at work in you. But quit thinking it's going to be recognizable to you. I'll come in a manger. I'll come birthed in a stable. You weren't expecting that. I'll go to a tomb before I'll be resurrected. You weren't expecting either. I'll work through a former persecutor who on his way to conversion participates in the death of my saints. And when my saints cry out under the fifth of the sixth seal, how long, O Lord? I'll tell them, you still have to wait. I'm still redeeming because my heart is hooked on redeeming the people I made with my imprint. God is the Redeemer. So is he redeeming us? I think so. But I think it's nerve-wracking. I think it's nerve-wracking because we don't recognize it. And the process is foreign. Everybody wants to be inspired by Helen Keller. Nobody wants to be Helen Keller. You know, we want to hear these stories. How many of you are familiar with what we have termed a non-institutional church? You familiar with this a little bit? I didn't grow up in church, and so I had to hear about it and learn about it. The idea that you wouldn't take money out of the treasury to support like an orphan's home. You out of the generosity of your heart would do it, but the church itself would not do it. You remember I told you that the girls were from El Cajon, California, and their dad was a preacher at a non-institutional church in El Cajon, California, that God gave $4,000 to and said, help. And that church said, we'll do it. And they did it. You say, well, I wasn't expecting that. Well, God says, I didn't ask you. I just thought I'd do it. I'm redeeming. I didn't promise you that it would be recognizable, and I didn't promise it wouldn't be foreign to you. I just said I would do it. What could happen if somehow we could come to peace with God not having to run his plans by us before we'd be happy about it? Wouldn't that be something? What if God just said, you know, I have a feeling that if Don was ready for that youth thing, he'd have blown it. He'd have had something in mind, and then I'd have had to shut him up or duct tape him or something. So instead of letting him know, I just got to not let him know so that he won't get in the way this time. Why not?
Well, we're only going to send our finest youth to these youth rallies. So if we find out that one of our girls is struggling, we won't let her go.
Really? You mean God can't work his miracle? What about the thief on the cross? How does that work?
Jesus, would you like to do one last one? A pardon right before you die. Yes, bring forward the worthy, kind of like a U.S. president there at the end, and we'll bestow pardon.
No, he said, let me do this. The very last guy that I'm going to redeem before I die is just give me the worst guy you got. Because I'm trying to get people to realize this, I'm the redeemer. And I don't have to make it noticeable to you. I don't have to explain it to you. It doesn't have to be something that you understand, and it can be completely foreign. But I expect my covenant people to get a feel for me, to learn to see my fingerprints, to feel my heartbeat and their pulse. So even when it's different, they know I'm at work. When God decided to introduce us to this ministry to people in addiction, it was amazing. Our church had been around by then over 40 years. We'd never had anybody cuss from the pulpit. Can't say that now. Things happen. But on the morning when the brother did cuss from the pulpit, he looked over at me and he said, that's not what I meant to say. I thought, I'm sure you're right. All the oxygen in four counties had been sucked out of the auditorium. Of course, everybody that was in addiction, they're high-fiving each other back there. One of our shepherds, Tom Einzelman, he walks forward, puts his arm around the guy, looks at the church and says, aren't you glad we got that out of the way? Which means what? We had an elder that could feel the heartbeat of God in his pulse. Was he redeeming? Yes. Did he make it recognizable? No. Was it foreign? Yes. He doesn't have a problem with that. I've got a problem with that. How is he going to redeem your wayward grandchild? How is he going to redeem your wayward child? How is he going to restore your broken heart? If you think it is going to come through recognizable ways, then you imagine that God is going to limit himself to worldliness for redemption. But he's not going to use worldliness. He's going to use his infinite grace and wisdom and creativity. God is the Redeemer, and it is full intention to redeem you. Most of us are kind of hooked on three things. We're hooked on safety, satisfaction, and stimulation. We want safety, however we define it. We want satisfaction, enough food, enough money, enough relationships. We want stimulation, that I'm alive. But how we go about getting those things, safety and satisfaction, stimulation. We can actually try to become the kings and queens of our own lives. And when we do, then we become the center and we push God to the extremities. So when God tries to work, He appears off center. I can remember going on campaigns. Campaigns Northeast. I was a young student at Harding. I'd been a Christian 5 or 6 months. Went on campaigns. My wife grew up in a wonderful church in Indiana. The same guy that baptized Alexander Campbell baptized her great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. I'm not kidding. That really is the truth. You get a little certificate when you marry someone like that. Don't mess this one up. Okay, we got it. You know. I'm up in Clarion, Pennsylvania. I'm knocking on doors. I knock on a lady's door. She tells me she's a Christian. She asks me if I have the Holy Spirit. I said, I think I do. She said, do you speak in tongues? I said, not yet. She said, would you like to? I said, I don't know. She said, well, our pastor will come over and he'll help you. Meet us over here on the following Tuesday. This was a Friday. Meet us on the following Tuesday. I said, okay. So I went over there Tuesday, went through the whole experience. I called my wife, or my wife-to-be, my fiance at the time, Susan, and she said, well, how was your day campaigning? I said, it was great. She said, what'd you do? I told her. I went over and had a guy lay hands on me to speak in tongues. She said, shh. I said, what? She said, let me go to another room. Why? I don't want my parents to hear this. See, what we're imagining is, oh my goodness, if God was to do some miracle, or if God was to work through the girl in the back of the room who doesn't have all of her stuff together, then we're thinking to ourselves, He is off center. You realize He's never off center. So if His ways bother us, we're off center. But you know what's beautiful about Him? He can use us off center. Because that's what He's like. When Jesus healed the blind man, do you remember the question the disciples asked? Who sinned? This man or his parents that he was born blind? What's Jesus' answer? Neither. That's an off-center answer. How do you know? Because what's always been the answer? If you do good, you get good. If you do bad, you get bad. What was the answer for Job? If you're getting bad, you must have done bad no matter what you say. So if you're a man born blind, you must have done bad, or somebody did. Jesus gives an off-center answer. And then He does an off-center miracle. And in the midst of it all, He doesn't just redeem the blind man, but He redeems His own followers, that God is at work. If there's anything I hope happens over the next few days as we're together, is that we can understand that to a person, man and woman, boy and girl in this room tonight, God is about your redemption. He's already working. He's active. If you're slow or in a slump, if you're at high gear and you're on top of the world, He is active in your life. If you think you're the only person in here tonight that isn't getting it, you need to know that He's already got you. He is at work. And so tonight we're going to close our time together with just a thought, a time of reflection about how God works in redemption, in the redemption of the blind man.
I am lost in blindness, and I refuse to believe that I can see. One has to accept a life of darkness. Years from now, I can only tell my children not to believe that simple grace triumphs over utter darkness. I was born in sin, and I was conceived in sin. It doesn't matter to God that I live every day of my life in hopelessness. No longer can it be said that there is a God who hears the cries of His people. My whole life testifies to one truth. Blindness has robbed me of every good thing. And it is no longer true that God saves those who are crushed in spirit. Now, I don't know much, but I know one thing for sure. I was born blind, with no hope and no future. But then I met Jesus, and He turned everything in my life upside down. I was born blind with no hope and no future. Now I don't know much, but I know one thing for sure. God saves those who are crushed in spirit. And it is no longer true that blindness has robbed me of every good thing. My whole life testifies to one truth. There is a God who hears the cries of His people. No longer can it be said that I live every day of my life in hopelessness. It doesn't matter to God that I was born in sin and I was conceived in sin. Simple grace triumphs over utter darkness. Years from now, I can only tell my children not to believe that one has to accept a life of darkness. I can see, and I refuse to believe that I am lost in blindness.